2003 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session 352. How many members are there really? Two censuses and the meaning of LDS members in Mexico and Chile. A paper presented by David Clark Knowlton with responses by Hugo Elias and Alan Sumnall.
Proved to be a very, very fascinating, interesting session. I don't know how many people here are internet nuts, but there's been quite a few, quite a bit of information on as the growth that the Mormon Church claims to have inflated or not, and there's been some rather interesting websites developed and studies and that sort of thing. It's nice to know that we're going to get some scholarly views on it from two people who are very meticulous in their research and very academically picky, both with David Knowlton and with Hugo. I've known both David and Hugo for quite a long time. They're both very good cooks when it comes to, well, food in general, but especially Latin food. And I've always maintained that David needs to write a cookbook with his recipes on one side, poetry on another, and a CD with him playing the various instruments he's able to play to go along with it. I haven't talked him into doing it yet, but he's a very, very talented individual, along with his academics. And Hugo is a very good cook, too, I might add. Okay, now that I've embarrassed both of them, and I know this doesn't have anything to do with the presentation, the one thing that I have appreciated about both these friends is the fact that I've seen this time and again, they're very picky about research. When they find something, you've got to nail it down. And like if I happen to bring them a tidbit of something, they said, okay, where'd you get it? How accurate is it? They just, take me through the ringer, which is good. And that's the way it should be in any research. So what I'm saying is I'm sure that this presentation is going to be extremely credible. And on a personal note, I will mention that David is the kind of professor, very concerned about his students. He's the kind of professor that I hope that I would have been if I had taken the academic route. And Hugo is the type of Argentinian that I hope I would have been if I had been born in Argentina. And with no further ado, I'll turn it over to David Knowlton, followed by Hugo.
I guess we should add that we have a third speaker who is also a fine scholar.
I apologize. That was a mistake.
What's your
name? Alan
Sumnall. Alan Sumnall is doing a PhD in New Orleans, right, in the university there?
Tulane.
In Tulane University, and he's also doing research in religious studies in Latin America. And he's on a mission in my country.
Well, welcome everybody. It's delightful to be here with you. I see many people, of course, that I know and many of your friends, and welcome. It's good to see you. The issue of how many members are there really is rather a difficult issue and a hot topic for reasons that Jay mentioned. By the way, Jay, thank you for all your kind exaggerations. It's a difficult issue. It's an issue that's laden with all kinds of significance and strong feelings on many different sides. On the one hand, there's the very powerful feeling of the church as a stone cut forth from the mountain, in the prophecy, that's willing to fill the earth. And the numbers of members that are published in the church would seem to be confirmation of that, and they certainly use that way in official church publications. And then on the other hand, there are feelings that the church, among scholars as well as many other people, that the church for various reasons chooses to exaggerate the number of members that are there and to count everybody who they possibly can in any context they possibly can for ideological ends. It makes a very difficult area to move into, and so what I'd like to do is move into it and try to be as good a scholar as I can, and yet to speak to things that I think are important, that I think are very important. Okay, the issue is particularly telling and biting because, unlike the United States, many other countries do require their people to, on the census forms, to list a religious belonging. Now, traditionally in Latin America, of course, there was little point to this since almost everybody was Catholic. But as of the last 30 years, numbers of non-Catholics have certainly grown stupendously in Latin America. In Guatemala, we're down to where, Tom, you should know this figure better than I am, sure, but we're down to where close to 40% of the population, to 50%, depending on who's counting which day when, can be claimed as non-Catholic. In Colombia, it's perhaps a scant 10%, although a poll carried out by the latest, the main Colombian daily, seems to indicate there are a lot more non-Catholics than former surveys had indicated. Well, traditionally, though, in Mexico and Mexico and Chile have asked people to aggregate, to give their religious belonging. We started to see in the census 30 years ago numbers of non-Catholics showing up. They were significant, and people have been working that information. However, the data was aggregated, was put together as Catholic, evangelical, and other, and then non-believer, and da-da-da-da-da. Well, where do Mormons fit into that? Or Seventh-day Adventists or Jehovah's Witnesses? Where do they fit in? Are we evangelicals? Some people have argued that, and certainly at the grassroots, many ordinary people would see Mormons as evangelicals, and do. We're hermanos, we're brothers and sisters, just like other people. But you know what? Many Catholics count as evangelicals too, particularly charismatic Catholics. So the numbers become really difficult to pin down, and that makes for fun scholarship. But in the meantime, we have these numbers, these slices of a society that make it very interesting. Well, Mexico and Chile decided to make it even more interesting because in the last census, they published data for specific religious groups. And they're rather complex in the way they come out, but so I'm not going to trouble you with a whole array. But among those groups are the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, us. And that means that now for the first time, we have numbers independent of those of the church about membership in Latin America. It makes for a very interesting data set. It raises all kinds of issues of comparison. But as you know, the criteria for deciding on a census category are not the same as those that are held by the church for membership. So any kind of issues of comparison are difficult at best, and it raises questions and makes going to make it, I hope, a fun exploration. So I'm going to go ahead and talk. I'm looking forward to the comments of Ugo and Alan. And I'm also looking forward to conversation with you. I have a 25-page paper, but I ain't going to read it.
Do you want me to ask her this?
So where's the power? Professor who doesn't know how to work it. No, anybody know where the power is?
Right, let me figure that out.
Oh, in plain sight, of course, where it should be. Okay, since these are numbers, I figured that what we would do is, forget the black screen. Google, can you focus that for me if you would, please?
I figured it'd be good to put these up on the screen. Numbers make my eyes glaze over, so I thought they'd make other people's as well. The Census of Mexico published for 2000 was published in 2001. It's available very widely on a website that's spelled INEGI.gov.mx if you want to look at it. It's fun to look at it in much more detail. The numbers, by the way, are published down to the municipio level, which would be at the county level. So we have data now that cover the whole range of the country for Latter-day Saints. Well, the church claims almost 1 million members in Mexico for 2000. Church data for the last day of 1999, December 31st, 1999, is published in the Deseret News Church Almanac. It's 846,931. The census identified 205,229. That's a significant difference. Now, to be fair, the census is for people who are 5 years of age and over. I seriously doubt, however, there are 600,000 children below the age of five in Mexico who are on church records. Roughly, when you normalize it for to take account of the children 5 and 8 years and older, it's about a little over 20% of the church figure. Well, this was Mexico. It created quite a furor when the data were published. It was widely reported in places like the Tribune, among others. It's on Camorra. Is it .com or .org? I think it is. Camorra.com. The webpage has quite a commentary on this, and I know there have been papers that are widely circulated thinking through what this discrepancy means. Well, if Mexico were the only case of this, then we would have very little to comment about. It would just be one odd, arbitrary number. But instead, the opposite end of Latin America now, the very long, narrow country of Chile, some places only 40 miles wide, it seems like, but a couple of thousand miles long, has also done a census of publishing where they required people to state their religious belief. And Chile's data were made available in March of this year. Their website is www.ine.cl, if anybody wants to look at the census data. Again, they're also down to county level. In Chile, the church claims 520,202 people. Chile is one of the great success stories of Mormonism in Latin America, where the relative percentage taking the church numbers come, I didn't look at this before coming, but I think it's close to around 3% now. Do you know the numbers on? It's around 3% according to the church, which is a very high percentage of the Chilean population. Well, the census has stunned people, because the census is only showing 103,735 members of the church. Now, there, to be fair, Chile only counts people 15 years of age and over. But again, if you take and add those other people, you're getting a number that percentage-wise is equivalent to the Mexican census, within the 20% range, 20-25%. So we're seeing a pattern where two independent censuses, have now shown that roughly 20-25% of the number of members of the church claims in Latin America. We've got a little bit of a trend. It's a trend that requires thinking, that requires explanation, that requires clarification. So the first approach to these numbers, I thought, well, how do other churches compare? Since we have data for other religious groups, how do they compare with the published numbers? And Armin Mas, of course, is always telling us comparison, comparison, comparison. So let's compare. One of the churches that we can look at is the Seventh-day Adventist, at least for Mexico. Chile doesn't separate them out as a separate group. I think in Chile they're aggregated with evangelicals. In Mexico, for the year 2000, we see that the Seventh-day Adventist claim, and this, by the way, is from their annual report. It's available on their website. And give you the numbers. If anybody wants to look, ask me, and I'll give you the numbers. The Adventists claim 524,207 members in Mexico as of the year 2000. And that would be for the end of the year 2000. The census is more of a mid-year slice. But the census comes up with 488,945. That's a 90% correspondence, within the range of 90%. Very, very close. Yes, Toby.
Do they count children as members too?
The Seventh-day Adventists, I do not know if they count children. One of the things I need to do is look at what their criteria are on their for their membership determination on their report. So I don't know if they count or not. All I can show is just this number, and it's significant. There's a 90% correspondence, though. If they don't count children, that means that the Adventists are coming out in fewer numbers than the Mexican censuses. And as we'll see, they would not be the only ones doing that. So I really don't know the criterion for membership, so I apologize. Good question. But nonetheless, 90% correspondence is significant, whether they count their children or not. Let's look at another church. As I said, I don't have data for Chile. They don't separate them. The Chilean census doesn't separate them. Before I lay out the Jehovah's Witness, Ugo's going to put it up on the board. I want to say a couple of things. Seventh-day Adventists and Jehovah's Witnesses are religious groups that are very close in size to the Latter-day Saints. They begin in the United States roughly the same period in the 19th century, and have spread very widely throughout the world. Both of these churches, Jehovah's Witness and Seventh-day Adventists, are more widely spread throughout the world than are the Latter-day Saint Church. In other words, what I mean is they have a much larger percentage of their membership that's abroad than are the Latter-day Saints. We have roughly 40% still in the United States, which makes us very heavily North American still. The Jehovah's Witnesses are generally subscribed to around 15 million members worldwide. That actually makes them larger than us. The Seventh-day Adventists are about 11 million. They're close to 12 million, which makes them very much close to us in size. However, we're starting to see some interesting tensions around the numbers here. The three groups are categorized together by researchers in Latin America as para-Christian or as eschatological movements. Eschatological because all three seem to be somewhat apocalyptic according to formal classifications and to have a lot of reference to end times. But what I'm saying is they're separated out from the rest of Christianity as separate groups, or we are separated out with the Seventh-day Adventists and Jehovah's Witnesses. Well, to do this comparison with Jehovah's Witnesses, we have a problem when we look at the reports. Jehovah's Witnesses are very, how can I say this? They understate their membership, most people seem to argue. Official witness categories only take into account those people who actively publish, which means stand on street corners to give people the despertar, the, what do you call it in English, awake and the watchtower. Or people who go door to door to actually publish. And to reach that status of publishing within Jehovah's Witness is really quite a feat. It's not just the act, it's a religious status within the community that requires significant work and significant dedication. So in Mexico, the witnesses claimed that there were, 542,117 actual witnesses, that is publishers, you know, the formal people. Most scholars take the larger number, which is the attendance at the annual meeting, Memorial of Christ's Birth, which for Mexico is over 1,057,736. So there are two different numbers for the witnesses. If we look at these there and compare them to Mexico, do I have the Mexican one up there? Oh, the census says no. The witnesses claim 1,681,880 attendees for the memorial meeting. The census comes out with a little over 1,000,000. It falls right in between the two numbers, closer to the second than the first. Okay? Now this discrepancy should make us start asking questions. Why do people identify themselves a certain way on the census as opposed to church records? When that census taker comes or people look at that form, are they using the same criteria to identify themselves as would be used by the formal churches? We're seeing a discrepancy that in part may have to do with different criteria of membership, and it also has to do with the way that those memberships relate to Latin American society. So as we begin to think through these categories, let me show witnesses in Chile. Thank you, Hugo, if you would. This is Mexico, yes, Toby. Okay, let me show you what the Chilean census comes up with. If anybody would like a copy of the form of paper, I'd be glad to provide one, by the way. The numbers are there. The witnesses claim 63,301 witnesses in Chile and 156,145 attendees in 2002. Now, actually, that was in 2000. I don't have the 2002 set report for the Jehovah's Witnesses. I haven't been able to get that. They changed their website, and they published them in the Watchtower, and I haven't been able to get those numbers yet. So I'm just going to compare them with the 2000 number from the report, which is these numbers. The census of 2002 claimed 119,455 Jehovah's Witnesses. Okay? So again, we're seeing the numbers, the official numbers of the census are around, I mean, the official numbers of the witnesses are around the census numbers. They fall on either side. We're seeing a very common relationship, a common pattern, that suggests that there may be something broader around LDS numbers than just the oddities of the society themselves. Okay, what I want to do now is, first of all, think what goes on in people's minds when they look into the census form. This is a hard one to know. But one of the first things that comes to mind is that when people look at the census form, the first thing that many Latin Americans are aware of is this is an official government document. And that means that people are aware there could be consequences. And people think very carefully about what they put down on that reality, on that document, and how it might impact them in the future. So many scholars, evangelicals and others, have pointed out that Latin America is still, despite the growth of Protestantism, a Catholic society. Catholicism is strong. Catholicism is growing in absolute numbers. Catholicism is vivid and vital and has a very strong importance within social relationships. Even though every country has separation of church and state, religious freedom, nonetheless, Catholicism maintains quasi-official relationships with the state, and your baptismal certificate as a Catholic can have enormous importance within social practice. As a result, the argument is many people may be unwilling to label themselves as something other than Catholic. Okay? And in fact, many of the Protestants were born Catholic, baptized Catholic, have lived Catholic lives until they converted. and in many ways still live Catholic lives on the sides, even though they may participate in other religious groups. So this suggests another point, point number two, which is that religious identities and their affirmation often are contextual. What I mean by that is the churches, the evangelicals, the Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, and the Seventh-day Adventists may want people to be primarily Latter-day Saint, or Jehovah's Witness, or Seventh-day Adventist. They want people to have primary identities, where that's your single solitary membership. That is not necessarily translated out into actual practice of people. Well, even here in Utah, people sometimes have different identities than the official one of going to church on Sunday or being a Mormon. And when the question then comes when people sit down at the census form, which identity do they choose? The context of the census is important, but then also which among the range of identities might they choose? Another point is that people often have multiple religious belongings. Okay? People over the course of their lives participate in multiple religious groups. People participate in the course of a briefer period of time, a week or a month, in multiple religious groups. People may have joined different religious groups. So the question is, if they're only allowed one category on the census, which one are they going to choose? And the final point on this one is that in Latin America, the main religious distinction is between evangelicals and Catholics. Evangelicals is the Spanish word for evangelico, means Protestant, basically. The word Protestant is hardly used. And as a result, the common translation for Protestant would be hermanos, brothers and sisters. And so people might identify themselves as hermanos, and that might very well get translated into the evangelical category on the census, because the census, of course, gets ambiguous results, and the census takers have to translate these into numbers and categories. Oh, what did this person mean? And so hermanos then would be put into the evangelical category. I don't think that these four categories, however, even begin to explain the difference for Latter-day Saints. I don't think they account for 600,000 people in Mexico and 400,000 in Chile. There are a lot of other issues at stake. And so instead, I'd like to think through what it means to be a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. When the Church lays out its criteria for membership, it primarily looks at people who have been baptized, or children of record, which are people who have been blessed, as I recall. Those are people who are kept on the records, unless people are removed for church court action, or courts of love, whatever they're called, or if they're removed for people asked them to be removed from the records. Occasionally, records are purged. You see, if you look at the data, you see massive changes that have occurred, like in the case of Nicaragua. You can see reduction in numbers of stakes. I know that there was one statement that went around the internet very widely, which is the church never purges its records. Not true. If you look at the data, you see the changes. You see the clearing, you see deductions in members, you see stakes disappear, words disappear from the numbers. So, the church then has this very specific criteria. The census is very different because it says, people at this time, what is your religious belief? What is your religious membership? That is, in some ways, what is the identity that you have? That requires people to self-identify, to look inside and say, what is my religious identity, my religious belief? It's not an objective measure. It's not the kind of measure where you can look at any kind of objective facts like baptismal certificates, membership certificates, membership rolls, tithe payments, anything like that to prove it, to demonstrate it. Instead, it's that simple matter of a person identifying themselves subjectively. It makes for a very different kind of measure. And because these are so different, in many ways the numbers are not even comparable. They speak to two very different things. And so for the rest of the paper, I'd like to think through, what is the difference between the church's number and the census numbers? What utility might these have for us as scholars, as well as for us as members of the church, in one degree or another of belief? The official church numbers don't just speak to this form of membership, in other words, the numbers. They also speak to matters of salvation, matters that have sacred significance. In other words, when one joins the church, when one is baptized, one becomes, from LDS perspective, a very different kind of person. A member is not the same as a non-member, cannot be the same as a non-member. That rite of baptism changes your status in terms of the eternities from an LDS perspective. And then if one leaves the church and becomes a former member, one is a third kind of person. This baptismal rite, the rite of moving on to that number, is understood to have cosmic significance within Latter-day Saint perspective. But not only does it have cosmic significance, it also has other kinds of significances in people's lives. I would argue that that number creates a field of action, whereby the way you, the church, or the way members, or the way when members relate to people of other definition within that set changes according to which side they fall, which part they fall into. A member is not treated the same as a non-member. A member you home teach. A member you might try to activate. You might fellowship them. A member can possibly go to the temple. A non-member isn't generally qualified for any of those things. Okay, members can possibly qualify for church assistance, welfare assistance, which was an issue I heard spoken about quite a lot in Bolivia. A member can qualify for welfare assistance. A non-member cannot attend BYU. A former member cannot attend BYU. A non-member and a member can. These categories determine behavior. They determine the way people relate to each other. So they create a field of action, whereby people are distinguished one from another in terms of that field of action. So what I'm arguing here is that the church's numbers are not insignificant. Whether or not we agree that this is the actual number of members, whatever we feel about that, these numbers are significant. Because for Mormon practice, they establish fields of action. When I was speaking over the last few weeks when I was in Bolivia, I was speaking to a number of missionaries, and they were telling me they spend about 50% of their time these days doing reactivation, working with members. Another 50% of their time working with non-members. In other words, they're working the both sides of that, those fields, the two fields, the field of non-members and the field of members that are established by these numbers. So I'm arguing that these numbers have significance, not necessarily as absolute measures of membership, but in terms of Mormon practice, Mormon lives, Mormon ways of being, that they have significance. And that significance is relevant in Latin America, just as relevant as it is here. The other part of this is, though, then what are the numbers coming from the census? I would argue, and I'm going to lay out, I think, a pretty solid reason for the argument, but you can question this. I would argue that the numbers we're seeing from the census are the very highly identified Latter-day Saints, those who have very strong identities. Now, part of my reasoning for this is that when you're speaking of popular religiosity, it has not been standard to have strong unitary religious identities outside of a general societal Catholic identity. This has not been something that has been inculcated within people. Here in the United States, in a Protestant society, we have strong religious identities. People have belief. They have an identity that makes a difference in their lives. It traditionally made a difference to who you could marry, what kind of place you had in society. We have unitary religious identities officially that we can present. That's not been the case in Latin America. That means that when you're seeing numbers on the census, whether it's evangelicals or Catholics, you're seeing people who have an identity they feel strongly enough about that they will claim it on the census form. That's not everybody, okay? And I would argue that in part would lead me to believe that these are most likely people who are fairly strongly committed to the church, at least in an identity sense. My second argument comes from a study that was done in Bolivia. I'm outside of Mexico and Chile. Bolivia, in its 2001 census, did not ask the question of religion. That totally offended all the evangelicals and the among other people, and so various politicians, said, so there's no relevance to these numbers. They don't do anything. They don't have any political importance. So they didn't want to do them. Well, the evangelicals dumped on the Census Bureau, and then scholars got on the case as well, among them a number of Catholic scholars, particularly working with various NGOs, and so they said, okay, we'll do a survey on religion. Now, they haven't published it yet, but Javier Albor, one of the really prominent Bolivian anthropologists, published parts of it. He doesn't have numbers specifically for Mormons, so I can't do the comparison. But he did look at the children of people who had had religious conversion. And as they moved into adulthood, did they stay in the religion that they had joined, or where did they go? And this becomes very interesting stuff. But if you look at this, the retention of children, just scan down the list, you'll see next to the highest is Latter-day Saints. At around, where is Latter-day Saints? Right here, 82% of Latter-day Saint kids born in the Mormon Church in Bolivia, are still identified as Mormon at the point of the survey. That's pretty high. I mean, you're seeing high numbers for everybody, which speaks to the social significance of these new religious identities in Latin America. But the Mormon number is particularly high. The only number that's higher is Pentecostals. The telling number is the one down at the bottom. None. That is, people who are raised in families with no religious belief, the majority of them change. They develop religious belief. They tend to affiliate with churches. That again speaks to the importance of religion in Latin America as a social identity. So this, I would argue that this set of children are the children of families that identified themselves as Mormon on this survey. And as a result, those would tend to be the families that would most strongly inculcate their children with Mormon identity. So I'm arguing backwards that this would mean that that category, this fact, the highness of this number, the importance of this number, would tend to me to seem to argue that the numbers of Mormons are those who have very high religious identity. I would argue these are the people that Douglas Davies, a British anthropologist, has written quite cogently on Mormonism, identifies as a church within a church. He says that the Latter-day Saint community has a church within a church. What? What is a church within a church? He speaks to the group of people who are temple recommend holding members who tend to do hold strong church callings, live lives of faith, who are strongly active, who carry out the functions of a lay church. He argues that's a different group of people from the rest of the people who may be sacrament meeting attending Mormons but may not be temple recommend holding Mormons. Okay, they may have callings, but they don't necessarily move into this central axis of organization. I think this is a very interesting and important separation. I think in Latin America, we're seeing in these census numbers the church within the church. Another further point is the limited information we have on activity rates in Latin America, whether it's from the Encyclopedia of Mormonism or from my impressionistic renderings, or those of other people, or any other data we've come, fit the numbers, the percentages of members that we're seeing identifying themselves as members within the census. We're seeing a different category. That is, people who are strongly, solidly identified as Latter-day Saints. Well, how many members are there really? Damned if I know. It depends on what does the word member mean. And I'm not going to do a Bill Clinton, so it's not is. It's just, what is a member? According to the church, a member is somebody who's baptized or blessed. According to the census, is somebody who chooses to affirm that identity. In between, we have a whole range. In that is the drama of society. I will leave that determination of how many members are there really to God in the final judgment. I can't begin, but for me as an anthropologist, these numbers are fascinating and exciting because they show us a field of action. The one member of the church, those numbers, show us those numbers of people who've been impacted by the church, at least enough to be baptized or to be blessed. It gives us a sense of the range of Mormonism's impact on a society like Chile, where 800,000, or Mexico, 800,000 people have been baptized or blessed in the church. Or Chile, where 500,000 people have been blessed or baptized in the church. That's a huge number of people to be impacted. If you want another measure, Mormons are appearing in popular humor and comedy in Latin America. We've become a leitmotif in Latin American society. So we are there. The other number is giving us a sense, I think, I would argue, of the church within the church, which is in some ways a more significant number. If we take the Jehovah's Witnesses as a measure, the number of members in any external sense probably falls somewhere in between. I think other interesting questions can be asked by the census, though. And I think some of the more interesting issues come when we look at lower levels, whether it's the state level, that is the department or province level, or we look at the lower level of the municipalities to see where are Mormons, where do they aggregate. And this becomes fascinating because the spatial separation is relevant to different economies, different histories, different trajectories. In Mexico, it's the country on the map, I think most of you are familiar with Mexico's geography. Most people around here have at least been to the coast. If you look at Mexico, we see in the 2000 census that members are not distributed evenly over the space of Mexico. The northernmost states, no, wait, wait, the central area around Mexico City, which is the largest city of Mexico, the largest city on earth indeed, contains roughly 23% of Mexican Mormons. Mormons are extremely highly concentrated in Mexico City. By the way, Jehovah's Witnesses are too. Guess what? Evangelicals are not. They're less concentrated in Mexico City than the norm. Throughout Latin America, cities tend to be more heavily Catholic on the whole than do rural areas, okay? Mexico City is a little unusual in that regard. We have a very high concentration of Mormons in Mexico City. Part of this is because in the area around Mexico City, the church was established in the late 19th century in rural villages. those rural villages still show up in the census with significant percentages of their members still being recognizable. That means that we have multiple generations. How many generations from 1880 to the present? A lot. What, about six, seven? That's a lot of generations of people born in the church in Mexico. Okay? And the other thing is the massive growth of Mexico City and the way the church has grown in urban areas. Another thing, though, in Mexico City, we don't just see Mormons scattered evenly over Mexico City. Mormons are very highly concentrated in the area of the industrial sector of Mexico City. That is the northernmost part of the DF itself, the federal district, which is, let's see, I've got it written here. Okay, we see them concentrated from the northern part of the city. I think it's Madero, the delegation of Madero. And then out through the various parts of the state of Mexico that are part of the industrial area, where it's Coacalco, Cuautitlán, Izcalli, Tlalnepantla, Tultitlán, Ecatepec, Tultepec, Cuautitlán, and Melchor Ocampo. Those are the areas. It's that industrial corridor in Mexico City that seems to be the place that has drawn large numbers of members. Who in that industrial corridor has come member? Damned if I know. Some of these areas have a million people in them, so the census doesn't allow me to get to that kind of economic rendering, but it shows an important correspondence. We see very different correspondences when we look at Jehovah's Witnesses and when we look at Evangelicals and Seventh-day Adventists than we do for Mormons. Those speak to history, but they also speak to the place that a religion has within a particular political economic system. In Mexico, we see a very strong number of Mormons in the far north, up in the border area. About 20%, if I remember the numbers right. 23% of, oh no, where is it? Excuse me, 30% of Mormons reside in the northern tier of states. Just, you can see the north. If you want to run your finger from the Pacific, down around where Tijuana is, on up to the Gulf Coast, okay, that's the corridor of Mormon, a heavy corridor of Mormonism, where over, where around a third of Mormons reside. Another significant place for Mormonism is the state of Veracruz. It's very long, narrow state. Veracruz is to Mexico what Chile is to South America. Long and narrow between the mountains and the sea with great seafood and fascinating culture. Okay? Veracruz has 10% of Latter-day Saints. That's a significant number for a small state like Veracruz. Guess what, though? The real place of growth of non-Catholic religion in Mexico is Chiapas, the south. Mormons are thinly represented in Chiapas, very thinly represented. The south, let's see, where do I have the south here? I should read my paper instead of trying to talk it. Okay, the south claims 14% of Mormons. The state of Veracruz has almost as many Mormons as the entire south. If we look at Chiapas, there's been this huge growth of non-Catholics. Chiapas is a state that is like Guatemala. It's about 40% non-Catholic. And Catholics have been very, non-Catholics, Protestants, have been very significant in the growth or the blooming of the Zapatista movement in Chiapas. If we look at Chiapas, we find Mormons concentrated almost entirely in two cities, Tuxtla Gutierrez and, Tuxtla Gutierrez is the capital of the state, and the other one is in Tapachula. Okay, these are two different geographic regions, but they're both cities that are involved in sort of the modern contemporary economy. We find almost no Mormons in the highlands, the classical Maya area. They're all in these new economic zones of the cities. Another thing that's fascinating is Tuxtla Gutierrez especially is more heavily Catholic than the state. Okay, the cities contain 64% of the state's Mormons. They only have 90% of the state's population. Tuxtla Gutierrez, where a third of the Mormons reside, is 80% Catholic. That means it's very unlike the rest of the state, which is almost 40% non-Catholic. And yet Tuxtla Gutierrez is where we see the heavy Mormonists. We're starting to see a curious correspondence between large percentages of Catholics and large percentages of Mormons. That needs to be looked at more closely. But for me right now, what it says is that Mormons show a very different pattern of growth than do evangelicals. We're somewhat similar to Jehovah's Witnesses, but we're very different from Seventh-day Adventists. Part of the reason is that Adventists grow very heavily in rural areas. We don't. If we look at Chile, and then I'm going to quit here. Let me give you a map for Chile, Google, if you would, please. we'll say something else that's kind of fascinating. I just started to look at the Chilean data, so I can't give you, I could go on all day about Mexico, but I'm not going to. This very long, narrow country is extraordinarily different from region to region, from place to place within Chile. The far north is extraordinarily desert from Arica, the border of Peru, down to close to Santiago. It's a mining area. The far north is heavily indigenous. Arica and Iquique are Indian, with people coming down from the highlands, a lot of Bolivian migrants, Peruvian migrants. Real growth of Aymara identity has been occurring in Arica and Iquique recently, where people are actually speaking Aymara now. The south, the far south, is heavily European, and it's the area of lakes and fjords, a lot of German immigrants and Scandinavian immigrants. From Santiago, you can see Santiago there south, sort of mid-area between the big fjords. You can see where the country kind of corrupts into nothing. It looks like there's nothing but just ocean there. The area from Santiago south, about the middle part of that, is Araucanía, which is the area where there are a lot of Mapuches, but it's also the area of peasants, of farmers. That is the classic area of Protestant growth. Let me show you. That's the classic area of Protestant growth. Chile had an outbreak of Pentecostalism around the same time, just shortly after it broke out in Los Angeles in the early 20th century. We started an entire church, the Chilean Methodist Pentecostal Church, that spread very rapidly and widely. And from Chile, it spread into other countries. That's the core of it. But you still see in the census, that's where the largest relative percentages of evangelicals are in Chile. Not so much in Santiago, it's there. Well, guess where Mormons are found? Santiago's important, but we've got another story going on. I would have said Santiago. Yes. I love to think about Santiago. No, the highest relative percentage of Mormons are up in that far desert north, the mining area. Arica and Iquique show the, or the state of Tarapacá, show the province of Tarapacá, show the highest relative percentage of Mormons in Chile. Guess where the next is? I'm not talking absolute numbers, I'm talking relative percents now. The next number is in the very far south, extreme far south,
Punta Arenas.
The area that has a grandiloquent name is called the region of Magallanes, Magellan, and Chilean Antarctic. So they're all found in the Antarctic. No, they're found in Punta Arenas, in the town of Punta Arenas, which is also fascinating. I have no idea why there have been so many, why Punta Arenas has proven so fertile for Mormon growth. I really don't have an idea about Arica either. People need to study this. I was asking in Chile, who knows? But part of the context has to do with the economy of mining, the migration of people there because of the jobs, and then also this growth of ethnicity, of the rebirth of Aymara ethnicity. I would suspect that the Book of Mormon story is significant within Arica as a way of people developing Indian identity, of people who are not developing an Aymara identity. That would be my guess, but I don't know. After that, the next place is Antofagasta. It's just down, we go in sort of a decline down the coast. Then we get the Valparaíso, the port city where Pauli Prat arrived. That makes a little more sense. And then we get to Santiago. Okay. Now within Santiago, which is a huge number, about 26% of Mormons reside in Santiago, Greater Santiago, as I recall. But within Santiago, we see that a lot of these things are not spread widely, not spread evenly across the space of Santiago. I need to do a lot more work on this, but what I can tell you right now is that within Santiago, we see that Mormons are not found, are weakest in Providencia, which is where the temple is. It has some of the lowest percentages of Mormons. In, where's Santiago here? Okay. Within Santiago, we find the lowest in Munora, which is where the first branch was founded. Providencia and Las Condes. Las Condes is the very rich neighborhood up against the mountains, the Andes Mountains. Mormons have the lowest percentages in the wealthy neighborhoods. Any take on where the highest percentages are? La Cisterna, El Bosque, and Conchalí. La Cisterna and Conchalí are two of the poorest neighborhoods in Santiago. This needs to be looked at a lot more carefully to see how Mormonism relates to these broader socioeconomic factors. For now, I just find it fascinating that where the temple is in Providencia, and And in Uruguay, where the first branch was founded in Chile, we found the lowest relative percentages of any of the comunas in Santiago. I think that looking at this data set, to look at the geographical distribution, to start doing correspondences with the other data that are provided, are going to help us get a much better picture of who actually has become Latter-day Saint, or rather, who are these saints church within the church, if I am right. And so I'm kind of excited about this data. Right now I can just give you a picture and hopefully tease you with it a little bit. Yet the numbers are not as big as we would have liked them to have been. But in Mexico, there are probably 200,000 plus very highly committed Latter-day Saints. Some of them multi-generation. They're raising their children in the church. They're practicing the gospel. They're living Mormon lives and they feel so strongly committed to their Mormonism that they will stand as census taker and claim that identity for all the world to know. That's significant. In Chile, little Chile, bless its heart, that narrow neck of a country, no Book of Mormon references. In Chile, there are 100,000 Mormons who will stand up and be counted. To quote the Doctrine and Covenants, many are called, but few are chosen. Let me paraphrase that. Many are called, not quite as many are chosen, but there's still many. Thank you very much.
First, I have to begin by acknowledging my gratefulness to Tulane University for providing me with a graduate travel grant in order to be here to respond to David's paper, which I received on Wednesday, I think, or Thursday. And unfortunately, up until probably Thursday or Friday, the Mexican census website has been down. So I wasn't able to look at that very much. I was able to print out some of the data on the Chilean census in the website. So some of my comments will be directed more so towards Chile, and David will have to discuss whether my points bear out in the Mexican census as well. I'm going to speak specifically to David's paper, which he kind of just summarized, but my comments are specifically geared towards his paper. And like all his scholarship, it's thoughtful and it's thorough. However, one thing he fails to point out, which would have been a benefit to those scholars or those interested in Latin America, but not necessarily familiar with the church in Latin America, is that Mexico and Chile are two of the four most LDS populated nations in Latin America. Mexico ranking first and Chile ranking third. And then worldwide, interestingly enough, they rank second and fourth as far as LDS populated nations. With this in mind, the results of these censuses take on even more significance. And unlike David's optimism, for me, these results, while not surprising, are disturbing. As David has pointed out, these censuses probably do not reveal the exact number of active Mormons. Omitting people under the age of 15 in Chile and those under the age of 5 in Mexico obviously discounts active members of the church who are youth. At the same time, however, he admits that, quote, when the census asks people to state their religious membership, it asks them to make a public affirmation of current religious identity. Note that this is not the same as asking if they are religiously active, close quote. I would argue at the same time, however, that at least three of the 4 points that David brings up as indicators that might skew the censuses are probably only nominally influential, in my opinion. I think that point one regarding fear of reporting oneself as non-Catholic having some influence on not admitting to be LDS is unlikely. I would argue that such fears would be only geographically influential and probably less so in Chile than in Mexico. I believe that where this might have some bearing is in the rural areas, and it is in these specific environs where David points out, using the new available data, that Mormonism for the most part does not nor has ever had a strong influence. I also find point three for the most part unlikely, or at least not terribly influential in the revealed numbers. While I have no statistical data of my own to back up this claim, I would say that the nature in which members in Latin America adopt the American version of the church also dictates their tendency to see themselves differently than the culture and other religions at large, and thus are probably more adamant than not in claiming themselves as Mormons to the census takers. I think this at least holds true for Chile, except for maybe what David has just revealed with regards to the northern area with the new influence in the Aymara influence. I would also point out that adding to this would probably be the prominence of urban membership as being influential in my assumptions. Point four, regarding attending various religious bodies, also, in my opinion, probably does not skew the data more than a point or two. As David himself admits in his conclusion, quote, "It is safe to say that although official numbers are high and activity rates relatively low, there is still a large and strong cadre of Latter-day Saints in Latin America who live Mormon lives," quote, close quote. If anything, while it may not change the numbers reporting themselves as Mormons, it would only serve to reduce the percentage of those who would be considered active in a truly committed way. Someone who attends church once a month is considered active and might declare herself a Mormon on the census. It is arguable whether these adherents are truly active and committed, so possibly the numbers in the census could be skewed even downward. So ultimately, with the exception of these censuses not counting children under 15 in Chile and under 5 in Mexico, I think that the statistics are not so problematic. To this end, I think it makes David's study even more valuable with regards to the findings he has revealed. The first interesting point that David makes is that in Bolivia, 82% of those born within a Mormon household claim to that identity. While there is no similar data regarding Chile, the census does indicate that in most regions there are an equal number of committed LDS males and females that fall within the 15 to 29-year-old age group. While not conclusive, it does suggest that these members will be able to marry other committed members, rather than having to go outside of their faith to find a spouse. As a result, accounting for current fertility rates in Latin America, the church will continue to experience growth, even without taking into account convert growth. And if what is true in Bolivia, and likely in Chile, holds true for Mexico, it bodes well for the nature of strong, committed growth in these areas, even if non-convert growth in the church in Latin America has always proven to be a smaller fraction of growth compared to those of converts. It has long been postulated that the church tends to do better in urban over rural areas, and for the first time we have data on the spatial distribution of committed members of the church. David is thorough in his analysis of these censuses in this regard. The main lesson gleaned here is that the missionary activity and attitudes of retention must be reassessed. Fellowship must become more effective if converts are going to stay in the church. Here, the responsibility for reassessment lies with the church hierarchy, missionaries, and local leaders. Also interesting in the Mexican census is the seemingly ineffectiveness that the church has had amongst Indians in the southern state of Chiapas. I think that this study is significant in that it points out two important things. First, it indicates areas where we have had less success, and if looked at seriously enough by those in leadership positions, might motivate new and improved strategies of proselytizing. While this may seem unlikely, I will describe below how this is certainly not out of the realm of possibility. Secondly, it continues to suggest that LDS members continue to be more apolitical than Catholics and even Protestants or Evangelicals, which has experienced a revisionism of their history with regards to political participation. Another point that David's research reveals is that the church, both in Mexico and Chile, are less successful in areas that are predominantly influenced by Protestantism. The suggestion here is that, again, new attitudes of proselytizing and administration need to be implemented if the church is going to make inroads in these areas. I touch again on these briefly below. At this point, I would like to come back to my initial comment that the results of the statistics are disturbing. I must also disagree somewhat with David's statement that the church does not use its inflated statistics for propaganda purposes. While I understand the spiritual and eschatological reasons for using the numbers they use, it is another thing to boast about these statistics. In the May Ensign of 2002, President Hinckley stated that from the original six members has grown a vast family of worshipers, 11 million plus strong. The LDS website currently numbers membership in Latin America at 4,046,039. Taking the Mexican and Chilean censuses into account and extrapolating for the rest of Central and South America, real activity probably barely exceeds 1 million. So for President Hinckley to use the term members strong is most definitely misleading. Still, the church leadership has not failed to recognize the problem with its membership in Latin America. We may have failed our Latin American brethren over the last three decades, but steps are being taken to see if some of the damage can be repaired. The first event of these occurred in Chile in 1999. While speaking at a missionary conference, President Hinckley remarked, quote, "The days are past. The days are gone. The days are no longer here when we will baptize hundreds of thousands of people in Chile, and then they will drift away from the church. When you begin to count those who are not active, you are almost driven to tears over the terrible losses we have suffered in this nation. Now I am sure you understand my message," close quote. Then in August of 2002, Elder Holland of the Council of the 12 was called to preside over the area presidency of Chile. It is not surprising that David noted in his paper that in Chile, quote, "worlds are being consolidated in the face of low numbers," close quote. I would suspect that Elder Holland's presence has something to do with that. But they are doing more. Ever since Wesley Craig Jr.'s article in Dialogue in 1970, scholars have lamented the church's inability or reluctance to respond to the particular needs of its Latin American rank-and-file members. Specifically, Craig wrote, quote, "Discussion in priesthood meetings often center on such questions as, why couldn't we as church members work together in developing a housing cooperative or a credit cooperative or have church schools for our children so they would not have to attend private Catholic or impoverished public schools," close quote. It is our inability, in my opinion, to respond to basic questions like these that has resulted in activity rates in the low 20th percentile since at least the 1980s. My own experience as a missionary in Argentina in the 1980s only echoes that reality. As a naive convert of only 1 year, I was appalled by the high inactivity rates in the wards I served and took the independent decision to spend a good deal of my time trying to reactivate members. I am heartened to read in David's paper that missionaries in at least one area of Bolivia spend half their time home teaching and with reactivation efforts. Another important dichotomy that scholars have found with carrying the gospel to Latin America lies in the corporate church's unwillingness to recognize cultural differences in Latin America and have tacitly, through various means, asked Latin Americans to accommodate themselves to the North American version of the gospel. This has been entrenched by the fact that many local leaders in Latin America also work as church employees. David, in a Sunstone article in 1989, while writing about a different topic, astutely pointed out that church leaders needed to, quote, encourage Latin American Mormons to develop their intellectuality in discussion with their own history and trends, thus broadening the Mormon cultural domain by internationalizing it. Close quote. Thomas Murphy, in his essay on Guatemala, has pointed out at least one instance where there has been a recognition of the unique circumstances in ethnicity of faithful Latter-day Saints in Latin America and resulted in an independent interpretation of at least one gospel principle. It is important to note, however, that this was not a top-down policy, but rather a result of independent thinking by a few faithful saints in Guatemala. The infamous Third Convention in Mexico of the 1930s is another example. Still, many of its conclusions were rejected by the church hierarchy, and excommunications were carried out. It is also difficult to determine how widespread this reassessing is in the Latin American church, considering the influence of leaders under its employ. Another area in which I believe the church has the potential to help is with the creation of the Perpetual Education Fund. It is still too early, however, to see if this will benefit the saints in Latin America, but rest assured, if it does, it will mostly benefit LDS males. On the other hand, Bradley Walker, in the most recent issue of Dialogue, states that a simple reallocation of 10% of the welfare and fast offerings of funds of North American saints to the saints in lesser developed countries, and mainly Latin America, would go a long way in assuaging many of the saints' economic woes, including a large portion of the 50,000 malnourished LDS children in lesser developed countries. Currently, only 2% of the North American saints' monies are directed to lesser developed countries. Still, most recently, there has been some progress. Quite remarkably, President Hinckley, during a Mexico temple dedication in 2001, offered these words as part of the dedicatory prayer. Quote, may all who enter the temple do so worthily. Wilt thou seal upon them an endowment of righteousness, and this is the important part, that will become the guardian of their culture and the lives they live. I find these words remarkable and encouraging. The inference is that the church may be willing to let go of some of its institutional holds in Latin America and allow for more cultural diversity of thought without accommodation to the North American model. I only hope that we are not too late. Thank you.
I think we are out of time. Perhaps I can read the introduction and the last part of my paper, and I will steal 3 more minutes of your time, if it's appropriate. In December of 1925, Elder Melvin J. Valor of the Quorum of the Twelve arrived to Argentina to dedicate South America for the preaching of the gospel. Shortly before leaving Argentina, he said, the work will go forth slowly at a time, as the oak grows slowly from an acorn. It will not shoot up in a day as the sunflower that grows quickly and then dies. Thousands will join here. It will be divided in more than one mission, and it will become one of the strongest in the church. The South American mission will be a power in the church. Just like Elder Ballard prophesied, the LDS church has become, in all Latin America, a robust oak tree. Chile and Mexico are 2 of the countries that have shown the most dramatic growth. LDS families have broken completely from their previous religious traditions. In countries where many name their children after Catholic saints, some LDS families are naming their children after heroes of the Book of Mormon. If you are born in a Mormon family in Chile or in Mexico, you may end up with Nephi or Moroni as your first name. Even though at the macro analysis level, the LDS Church in Latin America is a steady oak tree, microanalysis reveals something completely different. Life of a branch or a ward displays an extraordinary dynamism. At the front door, members are getting baptized, receiving callings, and getting married in the temple. At the back door, members are getting inactive, being excommunicated, or having their names removed from the records. Some of those who leave will return. Others will be lost forever, marry outside the church, and perhaps even embrace a different faith. The LDS Church in Latin America is a healthy tree, but by no means is the only tree in the forest. Just like in the Book of Mormon, some of these LDS families will see a Nephi II and a Nephi III. But some of these Nephites will name their children Kevin or Ashley, or perhaps even worse, Guadalupe de los Milagros, Inmaculada Concepción, or Santiago del Corazón de Jesús. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Alan and Dave.